network operations. For instance, KFOX at that time was KFON. We had the station's operations for the purpose of selling radios. And as I started to say, KFI, for instance, was built by Earl C. Anta to sell package. And KFWB was built by Warner Brothers to promote their pictures. They didn't sell anything else. There was no other advertising. The first advertising that we got on KFON was some tailor up the street on Pine Avenue who used to listen to us all the time. Came in one day and said, "Hey, I always listen to your station." He says, "Why don't you mention my tailor shop sometime? And dedicate a few numbers to me and tell me, you know, what a great tailor shop I got up there." And he said, we didn't know anything about charging anybody for it. But he says, I'll make you a couple of nice suits, the two of you, you know, we're doing this. I and somebody else. And I won't give them to you out of my shop up on Pine Avenue. I'll take you where I get my suits up in Beverly Hills. So that's the way we got some revenue for promoting this tailor shop. And then it went on. Pretty soon somebody would come in and say, "How about giving me a plug for something?" And then we began to sell it for money. And then we didn't own, the Echophone thing went out of business, and then we were just in the broadcasting business. Our total operation was to sell broadcasting to people for money, and that was our business.
You have to eat.
And that's the way the broadcasting stations got out of what they were originally built to do and got into the strictly commercial operation.
See, that's the way.
It was a gradual kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm. I don't think too many people know that.
Well, I doubt if they do.
Really?
But like I say, many of the stations, most of the stations, were built for the purpose of promoting the ownership of the station, which was usually a business selling something. Westinghouse broadcasting stations now are general broadcasting and television, but in the beginning they were for the purpose of promoting Westinghouse products. And I worked for Crosley Radio in Cincinnati, and they built this radio station. It started out as an amateur radio station out at College Hill where I lived. He was an amateur radio operator, and I was. And we knew each other, so I went to work for him as a very young man. I was 16, I guess. And they had a broadcasting station for the purpose of broadcasting Crosley radios. And that's all they sold. Nobody else was mentioned on the station except Crosley Radio.
That's fantastic. This has been sort of a lifelong thing for you, hasn't it?
For me, it has, yeah.
Do you still have the interest? Do you ever...
I still have an amateur radio license.
Yeah.
But I'm just not as interested as I was way back then.
Mm-hmm. How about KGER? Was that a competitor or a religious station?
KGER was a competitor, and when they started, Dobbin owned a shoe store. So they put a radio station in for the purpose of promoting their shoe store. And then they went just like all the rest of us did. From the shoe store, I think they closed the shoe store, did away with it, and then they just became a radio station.
Just the same time?
Same time. But to start with, they weren't really competitors because we weren't selling anything. They were selling shoes and we were selling radios.
So they were out doing the same things later that you did, the remote zone.
Like all other stations, it started out as a part of another organization to promote that organization. Then later on, they just sold to anybody else that wanted to sell their product over the station.
What happened to KFOX? Has it been...
It's gone from one thing to another, and finally, I think a religious outfit bought it and moved it over to Santa Monica. It isn't in Long Beach any longer. No, it changed hands several times. And finally it went to a religious organization who operated now just like we used to promote their own thing. All they do put some other religions on it. They help pay for it. Because religions are really non-competitive, I guess. So they do have other religions on the station who buy time. But it's owned by somebody who primarily is interested in promoting it for their religion. But I don't even know what religion it is.
Oh, thanks. So you were at KFOX during World War II still?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did they do anything on the war effort or ship launchings or Pearl Harbor Day or D-Day or anything at all?
We broadcast a couple of ship launchings over at Cal Ship. Uh-huh. And although I stayed with the station, I spent most of my time with the Coast Guard all during the war.
Mm-hmm.
As a reserve officer.
So you didn't have to leave?
Well, the radio station went for itself, you know, and they needed, I went down to the Times building, which was the headquarters for the 11th Coast Guard District, and I was in charge of the volunteer port security force, which had private vessels and people on the beach and people in this and that and the other place that were volunteers, and some 3,000 of them, several hundred officers and so forth.
I don't want to keep you if you...
No, I wasn't going to do anything particular.
Okay.
We're going out.
I was
going
to ask you about flying, but I didn't want
to. No, we're...
You have time only. We heard the tape when you talked about having had an airplane, and I see your picture on the news. Which kind of airplane you had and where you flew out of?
Well, I had one of the old training type of ships. They call them a Jenny. And they were built to train flyers for World War I. And they were, many of them left over after that. They were good airplanes, and they were built primarily for training, not for fighter planes or anything like that. But it was a good airplane. It flew well, and there were a lot of them used in the barnstorming and various air shows and whatnot. And I bought one. I'd never flown before, never been off the ground.
How did you learn then?
Well, after I bought this airplane, another fellow and I fixed it up. It was damaged. Stunt flyer from the motion picture people wrecked it. So we bought it. And didn't know anything about an airplane, doing building an airplane, flying an airplane. I had never been off the ground before, never been in an airplane. So we took it over to San Pedro and rebuilt it and trundled it over here to the Long Beach Airport, which was brand new at that time. There were two of them, one down on the field down there owned by Earl Doherty on Willow and Long Beach Boulevard, and then the Long Beach Airport was just starting. Just a little airport, just barely big enough to get off of. And I took my airplane out there, and there was a fellow out there that was teaching people to fly. So for $10 an hour, he'd teach me to fly.
$10 an hour, that must have been a lot of money.
It was. It was for me, because I wasn't making very much at that time. But anyway, when I got the airplane there, it had never been flown after we fixed it. And they say we were not qualified or experienced airplane mechanics. But we got it all put back together and learned the hard way by asking a lot of questions and getting a little help from people that knew something about it, and took it over there. And the fellow said, well, has the plane flown after you fixed it? I said, no. He said, well, would you like somebody to fly it? He said, yeah, sure, I'd like to see if it flies. So one of the guys said, well, okay, I'll try it out. So he took it up and did a few stunts with it and whatnot. And he said, it's all right, it's pretty good. It's a good ship. I said, well, fine.
No, it's all right.
So I'll pay $10 an hour and teach me to fly. So I learned to fly in about, I guess, 9 hours, I think it was.
Uh-huh.
And I soloed 9 hours, and I flew for a couple of years. And
did you have to get a license like you do now? It just sort of...
After your instructor said, okay, you can fly, goodbye, there you are.
Oh,
and you took off and flew around and did it on your own. No license, there was no law, nothing. No regulations whatsoever. You could do as you please. In fact, we used to fly down low on the beach and scare the heck out of the people and... Some of the fellows would fly straight toward the pier, then go up over the top like that just for the hell of it. Which, they say there were no regulations and no laws, no nothing. You could do anything you wanted.
Oh, dear.
But I got tired of that.
Did you ever do any of the air shows or the meets or any of that stuff?
No, I went to a couple of meets, but I didn't do any of those. I used to go out and fellows would come out and they'd say, because I was still broadcasting this.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd say, hey, how about flying a little bit? Go up and do a few rolls and stunts and loops and whatnot, and we'll take the plane out and roll it out for you and crank it up, you know. Okay. But somebody had to crank them, you know. It had to take two people, one to pull the prop over and one on the side. And so that if I'd go up and do that, then people would come driving down along Cherry Avenue or whatnot, and they'd see me going looping right close to the field, and they'd stop to watch me, and these guys would go out and say, hey, how about going for a ride? $5, take you for a ride. So that's what they wanted me to do. See, I was like, come on. I never got any of the $5. I just was the attraction. So I did that, and that's about all.
Didn't you say you did some kind of a long distance thing one time?
Well, I did with somebody else. I flew from here to Chicago and back.
Oh.
Three of us in the broadcasting business, in fact.
What kind of a plane is that? Was it an open?
Stearman open plane. Okay. Well, semi-open. It wasn't strictly. You know, my plane was just two open cockpits. But this had a partial coverage. That is, the front end was covered.
It was really dangerous back then.
No, it wasn't too bad. I mean, we didn't think it was dangerous.
Every time I turned around, I'd be reading about some wonderful flyer, and he'd come in on one day, and then 2 days later, he'd be in a crash on the beach or something. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, a couple of them out there did. Some of them crashed right where I had a crash landing, only he died and I didn't.
You had a crash landing?
Yeah, the motor quit as I took off, and I had to land in a very bad spot.
And he was with you?
No, he had done the same thing the day before.
Oh my!
A couple of guys. One of them was a fellow who used to fly around here a lot, and he landed out in the ocean and drowned. A couple of others that crashed.
Did that affect your decision on getting into boating?
No, no. Those things didn't want to bother us any. When you're young, nothing bothers you.
about the earthquake. Was there anything when you were discussing the earthquake before? I don't even know if you remember what they covered on the other one, but they talked about this guy with his name here, Rucker, talked about you climbing up the towers and so that you could broadcast after the earthquake hit.
Well, our building pretty well was a shambles. The front wall fell out, and the back wall fell out, and other things. The ceiling over the generators collapsed and whatnot. And I finally got all those things cleaned up so we could get it going again. And fortunately, the main transmitter wasn't hurt, although the top was damaged, but it didn't damage the inside. There was a framework around the transmitter. It was a big thing across this room. The ceiling, but something fell in on top of it. The ceiling collapsed, but it didn't damage the transmitter, but the generator was covered up with about a couple of ton of bricks.
Oh.
These were big generators. Everybody can hear that wall long and about that big around. It generated several thousand volts. They're high voltage machines, and of course very delicate in the standpoint of dirt getting into them. So after I got them all cleaned out, blew them all out with a Velis blower and wiped them out and turned them over by hand, made sure they weren't dirty, and propped the wall up with a couple of 2x4s so it wouldn't fall down on the generators again, and got it going, and I guess about 10 o'clock, see, the earthquake hit at 6 something, and maybe by 9 o'clock or so, I got the thing all running again, and got some of the fellows to come back. They all left. I mean, I didn't want anybody to stay there. I wanted everybody to go home or whatever they had to do, and I just stayed down there to get things going pretty much by myself. It was dark. The lights were not on yet. The power hadn't come back on, but fortunately, we had underground power to our building, so the overhead lines that were all down didn't bother us any. The underground, when they got the main power station working again, then we got power. But in the meantime, I sort of worked in the dark to get things cleaned up. When the power came back on, I checked the transmitter out. It was working, so one of the announcers showed up, and I don't know who it was. It wasn't Rucker. It was a couple of the other guys.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to start broadcasting about the earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
And from then on, we just stayed on the air, giving mostly earthquake news. Everything else we took off the air.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't put any of our regular commercials or any of our regular shows. We just broadcast the dispatches and things of that nature. We were the only communications out of Long Beach for a long time for the reason that, you see, this was before there were police and fire and sheriff communication units. They had none in their cars. They did have a communication unit out of Los Angeles that transmitted to the cars who could receive them, and then they would stop at the nearest call box and call in, but they didn't have two-way communication. And Long Beach did not have any radio communication. Neither the police or fire had anything here in Long Beach, so we became the communication center for the city, and we broadcast dispatches for ambulances and names of people that were rescued and the names of people that were in hospitals and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. Nothing but just, as I said, just earthquake matters.
Days.
I think we went about 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
We found one line that was good to the city hall. City hall was damaged and abandoned. You know, everybody moved out of it because it was severely damaged. But the telephone company, and I worked real close with the telephone company all the time, and they said, well, there's one line good down in the basement, sub-basement of the city hall, but we're not going to send one of our people down to get it. If you want to go down and get it, why, you can, we'll tell you the number, and you can pick it up and use it because it's good, and we'll connect it directly to the station because we've got a line from the station to the main telephone company office. And so I went down the sub-basement, found it, connected it up, and run a line upstairs. And since we couldn't use the city hall because it was in bad shape, there's a building across the street that was a bond, bail bond company, but they had moved out too. So we just took over their building and put our unit in there and run a line out of the second floor so it would be over the top of any high vehicles that came by and down to that building. And then we had a unit right downtown. So when our announcers are giving dispatches coming in by the Red Cross or whatever else, then we'd switch it to another man that we had. One of our other announcers came back, and he was downtown. We'd switch it back to him, and he'd talk to the police or the fire or whoever he could get a hold of down there that was operating out of the city hall, which now was moved across the street in a vacant lot. And we had one line that went to San Pedro, and we had a nightclub over there. And we induced them to stay on all day and all night. So this orchestra, anytime we didn't have anything else and got tired of talking, wanted a little rest, we'd say, well, we're going to have a little music from so-and-so's orchestra and switch it to San Pedro. And they would play a little while, and then we'd take it back again, and we had another bunch of dispatches and whatever else accumulated and so forth.
Was there any damage to your home? I mean, was everything all right on the
home? No, our dish cabinet almost fell over, but that's all.
Okay.
Nothing else happened. A couple of things, a couple of lamps fell over and things like that, but not real damage. We live over on the west side at the 19th and Golden, in a new house in a brand new subdivision developed over there. There weren't any houses around us. We sort of had a house all by ourselves there. Not a very big house, a real small house. It wasn't damaged, and nothing much happened to anything in the house. So we had a couple of lamps that were damaged, you know, fell over and that kind of thing. The dish cabinet almost fell over, but it just rocked over and went back again. But my office down at the station, the safe fell over and crushed a chair that was the client's chair that ordinarily sat in and talked to me, and the safe fell over, and it was Kimmenwood.
There's so many weirdnesses on that thing.
Yeah.
I wish I had gotten a little bit when I first came in and you were talking about your involvement with the movies. Would it be too much to ask you to repeat some of that so that we'll have it here and we can share it?
Let me give you another little story about the earthquake, which is real interesting.
Okay.
The hospitals began to run out of denatured alcohol, which they use a lot of in the hospitals. But they wouldn't use anything except bonded alcohol. So the one in San Pedro called me and said, this is one of the things we did for hospitals. If they needed supplies, we'd put a dispatch. Anybody got whatever the supplies were they needed, and a lot of people listen to us, and if you have these supplies, bring them to a certain hospital or get to wherever they were to be needed. This hospital needed the denatured alcohol. They used a lot of it in the hospital, and they were running out of it. And so they said, well, you put out a dispatch and see if anybody has any denatured alcohol. It's got to be bonded because we don't dare use it unless it's pure. Mm-hmm. And see if you can get some for us. So we put the call out, and we had, Long Beach by that time was under martial law. Mm-hmm. The Navy and the military took over, and we had a contingent of sailors behind our building because we had a back entrance. The front entrance you couldn't get through because it was damaged too bad. And then they had another contingent of Marines that were in the front end to keep anybody from trying to get into the building, because at that time we were an important communicating link. And there were a lot of rabid radicals, just wild people that were desperate to say something, ask for their family or tell their family we were all right, and we couldn't permit them to come barging in. So there was an armed guard at the front and the back. And after we put this call out, pretty soon the sailor that was armed guarding the back end came up, and they were guys, they had fixed bayonets, and so, you know, they meant business. They weren't fooling. And he said, there's a guy down below wants to see you. He's the most decrepit-looking guy you ever saw. Do you want to talk to him? I said, what do you want to talk about? He said, well, he said, you put out a call for some alcohol. He said, he wants to talk to you about it. I said, okay, bring him up. If you stand by outside the door, just in case. Because this guy said he didn't want anybody to be around. He just wanted to talk to me, nobody else. Hmm. So I told the guy, I said, just stand out there, but not too far away, because I didn't know who he was. And this was a character, if you ever saw one. And he said, you want some denatured alcohol? I said, yeah, the hospital over San Pedro needs some. He said, well, he said, I just came in from one of the ships on Rum Row out there, off San Clemente Island, about 50, 60 miles out. And he said, I've got some alcohol. And I said, well, that's fine. How can we get it? He said, well, I'll run it in just like we run the booze in. And he said, I'll bring it in for you. And I said, well, how are you going to get it? And he said, well, I'll bring it in like we usually do by speedboat, and we land it on the beach. And I said, well, okay. And he said, I'll put it in a hole. He said, we got a cave in those cliffs down there along Ocean Boulevard where we put our stuff when we deliver. And then the pickup picks it out of there. I said, well, fine. Tell me where it is. And he said, well, it's so-and-so from Cherry Avenue. And I said, fine. And he said, I'll have it pretty soon. So he left. Pretty soon he came back, and about an hour or so, he came back, a couple hours, I guess. And he said, I got it. And I said, where is it? He said, it's in this cave, I told you. And he said, it's all there. There's five-gallon tins of it. And I said, well, can we pay for it? No, you can't pay us for it. He said, we want to help people out. And I said, well, can I take you back down to where you got on the beach? No. He said, I'll get back down there my own way. I said, well, I got a patrol car. Oh, no, why do they do that? He said, no way. He said, I'll get back down again. And I said, well, fine. Thank you very much. And he said, don't go down right away. Give me a chance to the patrol. The speedboat will pick me up, and I'll be out of there. So I said, okay, I'll wait an hour or so. That's plenty of time. So in about an hour, I called a police car, and he said, go down and get that stuff that's in this cave and that cliff down there. And if you got it, let me know, and I want to send it to the hospital in San Pedro. Pretty soon, he come back up to the station. He said, yeah, I got it. I got five gallon tins of alcohol, and it's all marked bonded, stamped and sealed. And I called the hospital and told them I got it. At that time, I had a communication link over to the other side, because we had one line to San Pedro, which I could talk on. And they said, fine, send it over to us. And so I sent it over, and that was the end of that. Didn't pay anybody for it, didn't thank anybody for it. Don't know where it came from, except it came from Rum Row.
Rum Row.
Yeah, the rum runners brought it into us. They said, we're listening to you out there. We're listening to all that's going on in there. And when we heard you say you needed bonded alcohol, we had it. So you know, in those days, the liquor that you bought, they'd put a label on it, but it was all alcohol flavored with whatever you wanted. Rum, scotch, bourbon, you name it, they was alcohol flavored with something, colored.
Oh, I didn't
So they had.
This is after Prohibition, though, right?
Yeah, but they were still running a lot of stuff in for free. I don't know why, but they did.
Yeah,
you see, because you don't pay any tax on it.
Okay.
They're still doing it in the East, you know.
No, I didn't know.
Still got some. You're making booze back there selling it because they don't pay any taxes. I guess that's why they were doing it, I suppose. I don't know why. But they had it anyway.
Well, then he gave out the whereabouts of his cave, though, too, didn't he?
Well, I guess. Well, he said, you know, they probably wouldn't use that one again. They'd find another one.
There used to be caves all along?
Well, there were. The kids used to dig holes in that bank all the time.
Oh, they
did a couple of them. When I was with the Marine Department, we had a couple of them that were severely injured. The cave, things caved in. We tried to keep from stop the kids from doing this, but you can't stop kids from digging holes. We'd fill them up as fast as we see them digging. Unless the lifeguards saw them doing it, they'd run them away and make them stop. But they still got in there and dug holes.
That's a wonderful story.
Let's see, you want to know about what I'm doing in the motion picture?
Well, yeah, I just thought that would be awesome.
Well, you said I'm a radio amateur, and I was in the communication business and the broadcasting business. It was all wrapped up in one kind of thing, radio communication, one way or another. I had developed some mobile units for the broadcasting business, which we set into Los Angeles and was broadcast by KFWB primarily, and we fed some of it to some other stations, and we fed some to Santa Barbara and some down to San Diego and Phoenix. We had a little sort of a private network. It wasn't continuous. It was just when wanted. But I had these mobile units, and one day MGM called me and said, we're making a picture out here called, it calls for some boats coming in out of a fog bank and this and that and the other thing. And he says, we've been working on this thing for weeks and weeks. And he said, I understand that you can handle communications. Could you do anything about it? And I said, well, I don't know. I'll try. Let me go out and see what you're doing. So I took some equipment out with me, and I took a couple of receivers and a transmitter. And they had a great big barge in which they had the cameras and all the stuff, great big rock barge, which made a stable platform for their cameras. And they said, we've been trying to make a ship come out of a fog bank. This was off the east end of Catalina Island. And this sailing vessel, which was that one in there, is supposed to come out of this fog bank, and they're supposed to be in this fog bank groping their way back home from their fishing off the banks of Newfoundland, and they're supposed to come out of this fog bank and suddenly in bright sunshine, and we can't seem to get these two ships to come out of this fog bank without these water taxis that make the smoke which makes the fog bank. They go back and forth and make a great big smoke screen, and that was the fog bank, and then the ships were supposed to come out of it. But we always get mixed up. They don't come out in the right place, or the water taxis are in the road. They don't get out of the road soon enough. And if we could just talk to these people and tell them what to do, why, fine. I said, well, I'll try. So I got a couple of water taxis, and I got one of the sailboats, the main one they wanted to come out, and put a receiver on each one of them and set a transmitter up on the barge next to the director. And I said, okay, well, what do you want me to do? He said, well, tell those taxis over there to make the fog bank. They've been making them for days. They know what you want. He said, make a fog bank. And I said, okay. Taxi, so 1, 2, 3, so make this fog bank and then get out of there and go west, all of you. And so they laid the fog bank. He said, now tell that sailboat to see what he's doing. I said, okay, the Spinny, I think they called it. Spinny or the We're Here. So those are the two names I recollect. They didn't use that name.
Mm. And what was the name of the movie again?
Captain's Courageous.
That was Captain's Courageous.
And I said, okay, sailboat so-and-so, now take a course of such and such and come out of it. They were on the other side of the fog bank. I said, come through it and come out of it. And they did, and the director said, let me have that. He said, I got that. He said, we got that on film. He said, let me have it a minute. So he got to hold the microphone. He said, do this and do that. And he said, That's just what I want. He says, we've been wanting to do this for weeks and weeks, and we've spent a lot of money and time, and we haven't got it. And he says, here, your demonstration, we got the whole thing. So he said, you and whatever you need is hired for the duration of the picture, which is a couple of years in making. So that's where I started into it.